Welcome to Let It Roll, the podcast about how and why popular music happens, hosted by Nate Wilcox. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Let It Rollcast. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com. Today, cultural historian Jonathan Gould returns to talk with Nate about his book, Can't Buy Me Love, The Beatles, Britain, and America. The conversation focuses on the unique set of historical circumstances that allowed four lads from Liverpool to conquer the musical world. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. This is your host, Nate Wilcox, and I'm joined once again by Jonathan Gould, who's returning to talk about his book, Can't Buy Me Love, The Beatles, Britain, and America. Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
And so what inspired you to tackle this topic? Because, you know, at first glance, people think the Beatles has been done.
Well, yeah, and it had been done when I did this, which was, of course, quite a long time ago. I mean, the book was published in 2007, and I started writing it, if you can believe this, about 15 years before. It was the first book that I ever wrote, and it took me forever to finish it, or to write it, I guess, among other things, because I was learning how to write a book, which is something that I'd like to think that I know how to do now, or I know more about how to do it. But at any rate, at the time I started writing the book, the initial idea was that, believe it or not, there hadn't been that much written about the Beatles' music specifically. And my background was as a professional musician who then made a transition into wanting to write about popular music. And I thought I would pick a big subject like the Beatles and write about their music in a way that I felt it had not been written about before, in a way that satisfied my ideas about how to write about music. And as I got into it, I started to realize that to write about their music in the way that I wanted to write about that dimension of their story, I really had to learn much more about the world that they came from and the phenomenon that they represented. And I would say that probably added a good five more years to the writing of the book as far as this goes. So the project evolved from something quite specific into, I guess, what became a sort of generalized attempt to write about the Beatles, their backgrounds, their career, and their music, and to somehow integrate all of these things into a voice that could speak in the same voice about all of those different aspects of their phenomenon.
And to me, the thing that has kept this book something that I go back to periodically, because I'm just a crazed Beatles freak. The thing, as much as I appreciate your musical insights, and I think it is a contender for one of the better musical analysis written about the Beatles, but the thing that makes this book unique to me is, you know, you focus on the biographical, you focus on the musical, but your focus on the historical and your analysis, the depth you bring to the context of the Beatles, that to me, that's what's really unique about the Beatles. I mean, obviously, they're great musicians and the music's fascinating, but something really unique happened in 1963 and 1964 that had never happened before, probably will never happen again. And you do a great job of explaining the context that the Beatles kind of came into a place and time. It was almost like the world was waiting for something like the Beatles to happen.
Well, the world was waiting for something, and they filled that role. So yes, you know, one of the interesting things, though, that I've come to learn about the way things happen in general, is that it's very satisfying, and it's comparatively easy to create, to retrace the way things come about, you know, the causation of something like a phenomenon like the Beatles. But the other dimension of it that is hard to talk about has to do with the way it might not have happened. And the dimension that comes into play there that is quite simply the matter of luck. When I look at their story, at any given point, at many different points, that is to say, if things had gone a different way, if something different had happened from the way that it happened, we never would be talking about them. We never would have heard about them. I mean, this is sort of a little bit the genius. It's sort of retrospective, but this is a little bit the genius of this new film Yesterday, which you know, posits the question of, well, what would the world be like if they never happened? And of course, you know, I'm very aware of not just how they happened, but how they might not have happened also in that sense. And I just throw that out there because it's you know, in trying to write in an authoritative way about what happened, particularly in you know, 1962 and 63 and 64 in Britain and the United States, you can make it sound like it was preordained almost, and to some extent, that's what you do when you write a narrative, is you try to give it a kind of force that makes it think that, well, this just had to play out in this way. But I'm just throwing out there the idea that these things also could not happen. And at any given point right now, as we sit here, a group of, in this case, very talented, very ambitious people are pursuing a dream that we may never hear about, you know, in that sense. It will never make a mark on any on people's consciousness because the stars were not properly aligned to make it happen. But then, getting back to what did happen in the early 60s, it was an extraordinary period, and the Beatles sort of waltzed into it with an amazing kind of cultural wielding an amazing kind of cultural power, which of course they didn't realize until it was shown to them what their effect was in that way.
And you start the book with a prologue that starts with the Beatles landing in New York and doing their famous press conference at the LaGuardia Airport. And you summarize some of the things I want to beat people over the head with was just the magnitude of the Beatles' sudden explosion of popularity in the States in 1964. I mean, you talk about they sold something like 60% of all singles sold in the first quarter of 1964 were Beatles records.
Yeah.
I mean, and this was at a point when singles were the biggest selling record market, and records were a huge part of the entertainment economy. Mm-hmm. I mean, and then they broke the all-time TV ratings records with Ed Sullivan, 70 million people turning in, 21 million teenagers tuning in to one show all at the same time. There were 14,000 magazine stories written in a three-week period. And this was a point in time when everybody had magazines like Time and Life and Newsweek on their coffee tables, and they were read. I mean, coming from the perspective of 2019, it's so hard to look back and remember just how massive print magazines were at the time, and the Beatles sold gazillions of the things.
Yeah, well, it was also, I mean, you know, we're very familiar nowadays with this idea, as we describe it, of things going viral on the internet, right? And suddenly, or, you know, on Twitter, and suddenly there are, you know, 20 million people are sort of commenting on something or certainly aware of it in that way. In those days, before the internet, in you know, the era of print journalism and black and white television, and a very different, to say the least, media environment. There were two things about it. One was it was much more difficult for things like this to happen. But when they did happen, they had, I think, much greater force because they were so unusual. So, you know, one of the things that I learned, having lived through Beatlemania as a young teenager, I think I was 12 or 13 years old when it happened in the U.S. But having had a personal experience of it of some sort here, one of the interesting things to me was to realize, of course, which I guess I knew at the time, that it had happened in Britain and it had happened in a very similar way in Britain. But then I found myself asking the question, well, when I came to understand things about the Beatles' background and what they represented in Britain and so on and so forth, a great deal of what they did made perfect sense. A great deal of the way people responded to them made perfect sense, because they answered such an obvious sort of social and cultural need for young people in Britain. But then I asked myself the question, okay, great, but then why should that happen here in the United States? A very, very different country, particularly at that time, with a very different sort of attitude about many of the things that made the Beatles particularly sort of relevant in Britain. Why should that same thing happen here in, if anything, an even more compressed way? Because it took a couple of months for it to happen in Britain. The real, what the press referred to as the hysteria of teenage girls and the frenzy of the press itself really started in the summer of 1963 in Britain and sort of exploded over that fall. But what happened in the United States really happened between the last days of December in 1963 and the first 2 weeks of January. And suddenly the Beatles went from being virtually unknown to being completely ubiquitous. And again, that was the explosiveness of that was pretty unprecedented, I guess. You know, it had happened to some extent with a figure like Elvis Presley before, but Elvis, the explosion of what he represented was of a lesser magnitude, because among other things, the media environment was different and so on and so forth. Certainly in America, the Beatles fulfilled this need that I think people didn't begin to know existed. You know, they were answering it. Yes, a need, you know, that was unrecognized at the time.
And let's hear the raw material they're working with. This is a clip from the Star Club of the Beatles doing a Chuck Berry song, I'm Talking About You. And that was the Beatles captured live at the Star Club on New Year's Day, 1960, or New Year's Eve, 1962, if I'm correct, doing right. Talking About You. And this is crude, old school rock and roll. This is already 4 or 5 years behind the times when they're doing
sure.
this stuff. What was it about the Beatles as a rock and roll revival act that added to their success and made them such an, ironically, a new force in 63, 64?
Well, the whole Liverpool beat scene, which the Beatles became the most prominent sort of representatives, was a rock and roll revival, its popularity in Liverpool, which was this tough working class port, you know, 200 miles north of London, which in a certain, even more than a place like New York in America, dominated the culture of Britain. I mean, British media culture was totally metropolitan. That is to say, it all emanated from London. So a place like Liverpool had a sense of itself as a kind of a backwater, as a place that was, you know, but it also had a very strong identity. And in the early, really the very late 50s and the early 1960s, bands in Liverpool sort of kind of took up the mantle of what they thought of as old time rock and roll. Of course, it wasn't really old time. It was a few years old, but it had largely the work of artists like Chuck Berry and Little Richard and Carl Perkins, the rockabilly stars, had really faded from the airwaves. And this was a revival, and what they were reviving, they thought of, was the raw feeling of that kind of music. Everybody who was a fan of rock and roll in the 1950s had seen Elvis go from being this extraordinarily gifted rock singer to become kind of a conventional all-round entertainer, you know, under the influence of Colonel Parker and Hollywood and so on and so forth. And there was a sense of, to put it in sort of strong adolescent terms, there was a sense of almost betrayal that Elvis had, you know, left his essential nature behind and cleaned himself up and all of this sort of thing. So initially the Beatles, were a rock and roll revival act. But the thing that nobody expected, and the difference between what they were putting out at the Star Club in 1962, and what the world heard in 1963 and 64, was this extraordinary advent of John Lennon and Paul McCartney as songwriters. The Beatles gave an impression that they had that they'd been writing songs together from the very beginning, from the time they first met in 1957, and in a certain sense they had. But when you hear what they wrote, when you hear those old songs, or those early songs, I guess is a better way to put it. First of all, they're pretty terrible, and second of all, this is not what they spent their time doing. They spent their time learning how to play together and learning how to sing together. And by the time of their apprenticeship in Germany and Hamburg and places like the Star Club, they were getting very good at that. But the thing that I think nobody expected, and the thing that transformed their whole musical phenomenon, was the birth of the real birth of them as songwriters. And that really happened, I would say, to a large extent when around the time they began recording. And this is not unusual in the sense that often when people really start, when artists first start to hear themselves recorded, there's something that takes over that allows them to develop an awareness of themselves as singers, as artists, that didn't exist before. Anybody who's ever played music live knows that you, when you're playing, you're really, particularly in those days when the sound systems were so terrible, you're just trying to be heard over the sound of the band. It's not like you really know what you sound like. But when the Beatles started to record and they started to get a sense of what their voices actually sounded like and what they sounded like as a band, this had a transformative effect on their songwriting. And again, I don't think that they would have had anything like the effect that they had in a general way if in the fall of 1963, say, they had mainly been playing old rock and roll. And they certainly wouldn't have had the impact that they had in the United States because there wasn't much market for old rock and roll, in the U.S. It would have been seen as totally anachronistic in that way. So the birth of their songwriting, as I say, over the second half of 1962 and 1963 was the, in terms of what they were putting out rather than what the world was projecting on them, was, I think, a really critical sort of dimension to all of this.
And so you take amazing songwriting, incredible singing. Now, Lennon and McCartney were both world-class vocalists.
Absolutely.
And a very new style, but they take place in a context that's very prepared for them. I mean, the unlikelihood seemingly of four hicks from Liverpool taking over the world in an 18-month period, it seems impossible, but you illustrate in the book that this is all part of the post-World War II reordering of the global order. England fell from being the dominant power for well over a century and a half to the second rank, and the United States ascended to global hegemony. But part of that, in that process, England starts to mimic the consumer culture of the U.S., and it takes about 15 years for this really to click. But the Beatles, as war babies, they were kind of the lab where these experiments in inculcating a consumer culture happened. And one of the things I thought was really fascinating about the book is you point out how unique it was for a group of stars to emerge suddenly, and that one of the things that was new and novel, this wasn't one person like Elvis or Frank Sinatra or Johnny Ray, mm-hmm. who had all had these, you know, screaming explosions of fan hysteria in the, you know, period from World War II to the 60s. This is a group of young lads who at first present a fairly uniform image with their sharp suits and ridiculous seeming haircuts. But what was it about the group dynamic that allowed them to capture to fascinate a whole generation so much?
Sure. Well, first of all, in England, particularly, working class culture in England is has a collective ethos. Working class culture in England, which in Britain, in the 20th century constituted, you know, you can argue about the percentages, but 60 or 70% of the population. And of course, in Britain, as in most of Europe, where class consciousness was a real, was indeed a form of consciousness. People were aware of it. People would describe themselves as working class. In America, one of the conceits of our culture has always been, well, we don't really have a class system. And, most people describe themselves as middle class, and even when they do that, there isn't with a sense of powerful identity necessarily. And this was particularly true in post-war America, where it was felt that somehow everybody was middle class, or everybody was at least aspiring to middle class. In Britain, people thought of themselves, I guess a better way to put it is people thought of themselves proudly and consciously as working class. And the working class ethos was very much one of us and them, us being working class, them being the middle and upper classes. And there was an assumed tension, social tension and resentment and so on and so forth. And for many, many years in Britain, all of these divisions were enforced among other things, educationally. Middle class people were educated. Upper class people were educated. Lower class or working class people went to school until they were 14 years old. And then they went to work, as far as this goes. And that began to change after World War II. Britain totally revised its educational system and provided many more opportunities for working class children to get the kind of education that should prepare them for advancement into middle class life. But as with most sort of social transformations, it worked out better in theory than it did in reality. And of course, the Beatles, in addition to being war babies, as we think of it, were also products of that educational transformation. John Lennon, who was actually came from what anybody in Britain would have called a lower middle class background rather than a working class background, went to grammar school, which was their way of preparing people to go on to university, let's say. But so did Paul McCartney and George Harrison, who grew up on what the British call housing estates, which we would call housing projects. They were real working class kids. So the initial thing that brought the three of these guys together was the fact that they were to some extent isolated from their origins, particularly in the case of Paul and George, by virtue of the fact that they had these continuing educations. And I bring this up because what we're talking about right there was a kind of a dilution of the type of class consciousness that people like them otherwise would have grown up with. And what this began to translate into in the Beatles was a very interesting sort of mediation of the kind of collective sensibility of the working class, of the group, that is to say, and the individualism of the middle class, the striving of the middle class, and in some ways those two dynamics played out in them on every level. It played out internally in the group, in the way that they sort of governed one another's behavior. And it also played out in the way that they were perceived. So now, getting back to the sort of critical thing that you were alluding to, entertainment had created this category of public figure called the star. Hollywood perfected it. You almost say that Hollywood industrialized it. There had always been stars before that. I mean, Sarah Bernhardt in the 19th century was a star. There had always been performers who stood out from all of the rest and seemed to have some otherworldly sort of quality to them. But Hollywood really, as I say, institutionalized that idea, and some would say industrialized that idea, in the sense of Hollywood developed the ability to take just about anybody and groom them in a certain way and teach them how to speak and teach them how to act and behave and so on and so forth, and create this type of otherworldly figure, which was once pretty much confined to entertainment. But nowadays, in our culture, what we're really talking about is celebrities. We're talking about people who, you know, sort of by virtue of the way they look and act and seem to be, stand out from all of the rest. But this was always an expression of the most intense type of sort of individualism. Even if these people were created by other people, nevertheless, what everybody was looking at was this singular figure. There had been groups in popular culture before. There were the Marx Brothers, for example, but they were comedians, and they were comedians who assigned themselves these very sort of ethnically, among other things, ethnically stereotyped roles. They were an obvious act in that way, and of course the other great sort of expression of collective identity in popular culture came from sports, and a lot of the appeal of team sports, that is to say, which were the main form of sports that people followed throughout the 20th century, was this idea of a team, of a group of people who were committed to one another. In the case of the Beatles, however, what they did was, essentially, and it came very naturally to them, they took this collective identity that was in some ways very common in Britain and of a group of mates, a group of teenagers who were friends with one another. In America, they would have been called a gang. You know, there was that sort of stereotype. But this collective identity of a group, and managed to, with the help of the media and the help of what people projected onto them, ramp it up to the level of a star. And somehow or another, the alchemy, the synthesis of these two sorts of forms of identity, the sort of exaggerated individualism of stardom, and the exaggerated sort of collectivism of working class sensibility, created something completely new. And as it turned out, something extremely powerful in its effect on the imaginations of the public, both in Britain, where it was quite familiar. Everybody knew that this was a bunch of mates who had somehow somehow managed to project themselves into the public eye. But in America, that type of collectivism, that type of solidarity, was not just unknown, but it turned out to be explosive in terms of its impact on people.
And let's hear some of the early efforts of songwriting from John Lennon. This is John Lennon doing a demo of What Goes On, and mm-hmm. a song they wouldn't put out until 1965, but it was one he wrote in the late 50s. And here's him doing a demo of it in 1963. And that's John Lennon's demo for What Goes On, a song the Beatles wouldn't release for a couple more years. But it shows you kind of the nascent songwriting talent in its infancy. And one thing that I think that sums up what you've been talking about is what you described as they were a merger of working class solidarity and middle class ambition. And one mm-hmm. of the trends that you talk about that was going on in England in the 50s that built up to the Beatles was this angry young men movement and drama and movies. What was it that was unique about that, that seeing virile working class men that was new in British culture?
Sure. Well, you know, I mentioned in the book that Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel and John Osborne's play Look Back in Anger opened in arrived in Britain at almost exactly the same moment. And Elvis, we know what that was about for the most part. But in the case of Look Back in Anger, John Osborne created a protagonist named Jimmy Porter. And Jimmy Porter as the title suggests, he's an angry young man. But the nature of his anger is what was interesting. Jimmy Porter was exactly what John Lennon, Paul McCartney, and George Harrison was. He was a product of the post-war British, or the reformed post-war British educational system. Jimmy Porter is hyper articulate. He's an educated person. But many people, particularly in the first, in the first couple of generations of this, but it's been an ongoing problem, both in Britain and in some ways in the United States too. Many people in the first generation of that reformed British sort of educational system that was designed to give new opportunities to working class and lower middle class people were very found that actually there was no outlet for their talents in British society, particularly in the 1950s when Britain, the British economy was still in desperate straits as a result of World War II, there were still various forms of rationing in Britain in the mid 50s left over from the war and from the British economy's attempts to recover from this incredible drain of wealth that occurred as a result of the war, or rather their need to pay for their part in the war. So Jimmy Porter's anger was something very new. A character like this was very new in Britain. And it had to do a great, among other things, with how articulate he was, how self-aware and how articulate he was about his social position. So the idea in this case, a theatrical character, but the idea of a generation of particularly young men who were aware of how British society was set up to constrain them, how British society, as we would say in a modern day American context, the ways in which British society was rigged for the benefit of the wealthy and the upper middle classes. This was something very new there. This type of sort of social protest was very new. And for me, one of the reasons I start the book with Jimmy Porter is that Jimmy Porter, in some ways, is a prototype of John Lennon. John Lennon too had a hyper articulate sort of awareness of again, both the class dynamics of British society and the hypocrisies of British society and so on and so forth. This is one of the things that made, you know, within the Beatles, his social vision so powerful for so many people. So, you know, in that sense, it was new in Britain. In America, there had been a whole sort of genre of proletarian fiction and proletarian drama going back, especially to the 1930s. But this had not happened in Britain. So in some ways, what happened in British theater and to some extent in British social consciousness in the 1950s was more like what happened during the Great Depression in the United States.
And so the ground had been laid for working class figures and lower middle class figures to emerge into British culture in a big way. I mean, people like actor Michael Caine and many others were elevating British working class into the public consciousness. So when the Beatles emerged in early 63, Britain was ready for them, and they But one thing that happened and that you articulate pretty clearly in the book is their singles are successful, their touring is reaching larger and larger audiences, their album is a massive hit, mm-hmm. Please Please Me in early 63, but the British press doesn't really catch on until after She Loves You, after, you know, which is their fourth single and an incredibly big hit. And it sort of gives the illusion that this phenomenon came out of nowhere when actually it had been building up gradually in Britain throughout the year.
Yeah, well, it's shocking by modern standards to realize both in Britain and the United States, but particularly in Britain, how little coverage was given to things like popular music in just the general press. You know, even films in that period, they were reviewed, but you know, we have this massive industry now that we're all completely familiar with, where and of course the internet has magnified this, has brought this to a whole new order of magnitude, but where, you know, every record that comes out, every artist who appears on the scene, they're public figures. This was not the case in Britain in the early 1960s. There were fan magazines that were pretty cheap and, you know, pretty patronizing, and were purchased by teenagers. But it wasn't as if anybody in the general press paid attention to that. So yeah, this whole phenomenon of Beatlemania as an entertainment phenomenon was able to sort of reach a pretty serious sort of level of commercial success and public awareness before the press felt any need to look at it. Now, the other thing that was happening that added to the press's sort of obliviousness to all of this was that the British press over the course of 1962 was having an absolute field day with what in some ways was the prototype for all of the political sex scandals that have happened in the modern era, which was this, there's no reason to go into the details of it, but basically it involved a British cabinet minister named Profumo, who was involved with a call girl ring in London, that also involved an attaché at the Russian embassy, who was almost undoubtedly a spy. And so the fact that the British war minister, which is what Profumo was having an affair with a call girl who was also having an affair with a Russian spy. You know, remember, this is I think the second James Bond book had come out by 1963. I think film. Dr. No, I think, was 1962. I think the next one was 1963. This was a political scandal that was like something out of James Bond in this way. So to some extent, and of course, it involved all of the lurid details about, you know, not just the sexual conduct of these people. There were aristocrats involved. Lord Astor was involved, so on and so forth. So the British press sort of had all the red meat that it needed in the summer of 19, or in the, especially in the winter of first half of 1963. They weren't looking for other stories to interest them. They were completely preoccupied by the Profumo scandal, as it was called, and that helped to turn the Beatles into this kind of stealth phenomenon. But of course, then what happened? Because one of the things about the Profumo scandal, there was a famous headline on the Daily, I think it was the Daily Mirror, which is like the equivalent. I mean, it was the biggest tabloid paper in Britain. And of course, one of the things that's interesting about Britain then and now is that the newspapers are really all national newspapers. So everybody, you know, read these tabloid papers. There was a headline on the Daily Mirror that asked, "What the hell is happening in this country?" Right? This, I think, was in the early summer of 1963, and then, as the summer went on and the Beatles became Beatle concerts became the scenes of these sort of this kind of amazing demonstrations by screaming girls who the term that was always ascribed to the girls was hysterical, that they were in the throes of hysteria, which of course is a sexual is a sexual idea, a sexual term. The press started to turn its attention to this as yet another example of the possibility that Britain was just going to hell in a handbasket, right? It's like, first we have ministers sleeping with call girls and so on and this, and now we have these audiences of screaming teenage girls who seem to be in some orgasmic state of rapture, so on and so forth. And that was the initial kind of sort of attraction of the Beatles, the Beatle phenomenon, to the press, to the British press. What they found when they started to look into the whole thing, though, was something very different, because they started to talk to as reporters will, they started to interview the Beatles themselves. And the Beatles' behavior with the press, first in Britain and then in the United States, was revelatory. And I think this is, this too was, to the extent that they were the architects of their own success, not Brian Epstein, because their manager, Epstein was a brilliant manager and a visionary manager. But I think that even Epstein didn't realize that the Beatles would behave the way that they did behave with reporters. Normally, the way that people in all forms of entertainment and culture and so on and so forth behave with reporters is the way that I'm behaving with you right now, which is I'm taking this whole thing very seriously, and I'm trying to give straightforward answers, and I'm trying not to say anything that's going to that might seriously offend anybody, so on and so forth. In the case of the Beatles, though, they behaved with British reporters as if this was the biggest joke in the world. And the reason was that they had seen celebrities and pop singers and things like that interviewed before, as they were growing up, as they were coming up in their careers, and they had seen these incredibly sort of banal answers that people gave to reporters' questions. The one was the classic one was the way that Elvis, just couldn't stop talking about how he owed everything to his fans, right? And the fans this, and these ingratiating sort of responses. And the Beatles, for two reasons. First of all, because of their temperament, and their Liverpudlian backgrounds, refused to do this. They weren't going to say those things that were expected of them. And instead, they took on the identity that a lot of Liverpudlians took on when they were, especially when they're outside of Liverpool, of these kind of straight-talking provincial rubes. The British public went nuts over this because they'd never seen anybody behave. I mean, decorum in Britain at all levels of society has a pretty strong hold on everybody. And here were people who were behaving with no decorum whatsoever. On the contrary, they were trying to outdo one another in saying something, sort of outrageous. But they were also very charming, and they were actually more calculating about this than people fully understood. But the other thing about it that goes back to the group identity, which was that, most people, if they're fortunate enough to get on the elevator of success and fame, there's only one person on that elevator as it goes up. And people adjust individually. They adjust their personalities. They adjust their psychologies to what's happening to them, often without even realizing it. In the case of the Beatles, though, in a way that was extraordinarily sort of amusing and compelling, they kind of kept one another honest. They were a group of people, and this was happening to the four of them, and it was impossible for any one of them to sort of transform himself into somebody who would be taking all of this for granted, would be taking all of this as if it was his due or something like that. You know, Paul McCartney, who was probably the most ingratiating of the four of them, fairly early on, one of the band's standard sort of jokes, because people would ask them if they rehearsed, and their standard response to that was, you know, people, they were obviously talking about musically, but the way the Beatles took it, they would say, well, do you rehearse? And, you know, one of them would say, well, Paul does, but the rest of us don't, in that way, meaning, you know, do you tailor your personalities to this, you know, to this type of situation? And this too, the honesty that came through, you know, the lack of cant and the lack of sort of phoniness that came from the way that they would cut one another down all the time in interviews and so on and so forth was unprecedented in a public sense, and incredibly compelling to the British public. And then the same thing happened when they came to America. I mean, the reporters who met them at Kennedy Airport, they didn't know what to make of them. They never had people respond to their questions like this. They were responding as if they didn't take it seriously. And you know what reporters are doing when they show up at a press conference, at the very least, what they're saying is, this is very important. We're giving you an enormous, you know, an important platform of publicity, and we expect for you to play your part in this. And instead, the Beatles just treated the whole thing as if it was kind of a joke.
You've got a great quote in the book from John Lennon when a reporter, you know, sort of begs for mercy, yeah, asking, I'm just trying to write a nice personality piece. And Lennon,
right. And John says, well, I don't have a nice personality.
And let's hear one more song sample. This is Paul McCartney doing an early demo of All Follow the Sun, a song he wrote in the late 50s.
You look to see I've gone, for tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. Someday you'll know I was the one, but tomorrow may rain, so I'll follow the sun. And now the time has come, and so my love I must go. And though I lose a friend,
and that was Paul McCartney doing a demo of I'll Follow the Sun, and you can get a taste of the Beatles trying to perfect their art of songwriting there. But one thing that you bring out that I think is
I have to say one thing there. I have to amend one thing that I said earlier, which was that I said that you know, most of the early songs that they wrote were terrible, and I'll Follow the Sun is a very conventional song, but it's a beautiful song.
Yeah,
that's not a terrible song. That's a glimmer of the melodic sense that McCartney, of course, would rely on again and again and again as time went on.
Yeah, and one thing that you bring out to get back to the media is that around this time, social analysts like Daniel Boorstin were beginning to analyze the phenomena of mass media and the way it created opportunities for advertisers and pop group managers to manipulate the audience. And so the media was becoming aware of this, and that one of the reasons that so much of the early analysis of the Beatles was wrong-headed, because the fundamental question was, how long is this going to last? I mean, everybody just assumed that this was an ephemeral phenomenon rather than something that took off like a rocket in the early 60s and has stayed consistently popular now for six decades.
Yes.
Go ahead, explain that. Why were people so sure this was a manufactured thing?
You know, in today's world, we have fake news, okay? That is to say, we have the claim of fake news. We have the idea that the media, you know, prints things that aren't true, okay? Or that the news media, rather. In the early 1960s, there was a considerable amount of public awareness of what was then considered a relatively new industry, which was called public relations, right? Or rather, I'll say advertising and public relations. Now, advertising had been around for a long time, but there was a growing awareness of the manipulative nature that both, you know, sort of public relations consultants and advertising men, because they were almost all men at the time, you know, sort of the techniques that were used to manipulate public opinion and, you know, and consumers' consciousness and so on and so forth. And there were a whole lot of books that came out all through the 50s, most of them relying on, you know, sort of derived from some form of Freudian psychology and so on and so forth. There was one called The Hidden Persuasion, and so on and so forth, talking about these things that were going on behind the scenes. There was the famous thing about the supposedly subliminal shots of popcorn that were put in, you know, that were shown in the trailers for movies that would supposedly would stimulate people to go out and buy popcorn in the lobby, even though they went by so quickly they couldn't see this. There was this enormous sort of awareness and fear and concern about manipulation. And Daniel Boorstin's book is which is in some ways extraordinarily prescient, and in some ways is extraordinarily naive. An expression or a manifestation of this feeling. So when the Beatles happened, when this thing exploded, everybody tended to assume that somewhere somebody was pulling the strings, that somewhere somebody, some genius, right, was making the moves that would create something like this, that would manipulate the public's consciousness in this way. And of course, the obvious candidate for that was Brian Epstein, who was the band's manager. And Brian was in some ways indeed a very visionary figure in the world of music management, or especially pop music management. Brian's sort of standards came really more from the theater, and his idea of how it was to manage a group and how it was to manage the public image of a group had much more to do with the British theater and his experience in it than it did with the pop world. Among other things, he was no Svengali. He had no special sort of awareness or technique that he was applying to this. But in some ways, I would say that the kind of one of the things that supercharged the Beatles phenomenon was the way in which their immediate audience, the teenagers, who sort of turned out to be right in the sense that the adult world was saying, well, what's going on here is that somebody has found a way to manipulate the passions of gullible, you know, sort of adolescents to respond this way to this music. That was the adult view of what must be happening here. And it was relatively harmless and relatively amusing and all of that. And so then the question, you know, it's based on the idea of how long will it last, which was the question that the Beatles were asked all the time. The idea was that when would the spell be broken? You know, when would people either sort of like wake up and to see just how contrived this whole thing was, or when would something else come along that sort of captured people's attention the way this had, and this would fade away and they'd be on to the next thing, was sort of the idea. And all the time, you know, the Beatles again made light of the whole notion that this was a manipulation, even though they were very offended by it, because one of the things that came through in their presentation to the press and the public was and that was based very much in reality. They saw themselves as musicians. They hadn't set out to be worldwide celebrities. They were musicians. That was their identity. They were proud of their music. They worked hard at it. That was the way they thought of themselves. And they would like to think, and I think looking back on it, they were correct to think that the reason that people were responding mainly to them was that they wrote wonderful songs and sang them in a totally compelling manner. And then once they had established themselves on that basis, started to evolve as musicians and singers and songwriters in ways that were again fascinating to a public that was used to the idea that if somebody succeeded at something, they would just keep doing the same thing until somebody else came along that was more interesting in that way. So that was the Beatles' take on this. But the whole basis of the sort of adult view of them. And of course, this became another version of Us and Them, right? In terms of the teenage view of things and the Beatles view of things, us being us, the Beatles, us being us, the Beatles and our fans, them being this cynical, sort of adult take on what was happening. And, you know, then, fairly early on, you know, you had people, prominent figures, particularly in music, starting to say, well, you know, there's actually something pretty valid about what these guys are doing. And it was at that point that the adult view of whatever this represented, started to shift, because so-called experts, musical experts, that is to say, some of them critics, some of the musicians. A few years later, people like Leonard Bernstein became very prominent in this regard, because by the mid-60s, people like Bernstein were recognizing that that Lennon and McCartney were extraordinarily gifted composers, and we're talking about it in this way. But until that imprimatur of expert opinion sort of was applied to the Beatles' music, the adult view of this was that this was a kind of dream that had been concocted somehow, or a fantasy that had been concocted by somebody who really knew what he or she was doing.
And the Beatles were quick to figure out what was going on and were way ahead of the critics. There's a quote in here from John Lennon I think is pretty central to the point of the book. Lennon telling an early interviewer, "This isn't show business. This is something else. This is different mm-hmm. from anything that anybody imagines. You don't go on from this. You do this, and then you finish." And you bring in the German sociologist Max Weber, who had postulated this notion of charismatic leaders, that society occasionally hits points at which order breaks down and the normal hierarchies and paths to power don't apply, and these charismatic figures emerge, people like Mussolini and Hitler and Lenin that dominate society. And in a way, the Beatles became a pop culture version of that.
Yeah, I have a confession to make, which is that since most of my writing about this and thinking about this and all of this, you know, was done many, many years ago before we did this interview, when you mentioned that you wanted maybe to talk a little bit about, you know, the charismatic dimension to their success, I went back and I reread some of my own writing. Okay. And the only reason I bring that up is that, reading my thinking and so on and so forth about how that came to play in the Beatle phenomenon in the age of Trump was horrifying. I guess it's the only way I can describe it. Because Max Weber's whole view of charisma, and it was not a major, I mean, he was a major German sociologist, and his writing about charisma was a small part of what he did. And in fact, the whole notion of charisma, it didn't have a great deal of traction until the press started, or until writers started to use it. Reporters started to use it in the 50s and early 60s as a kind of sexy term for strong forms of public appeal. But when Weber was writing about it, it was in the early 20th century, and it clearly anticipated the sort of great sort of demagogues of the 20th century. And in fact, his writing about it resonated so powerfully with figures like Hitler and Mussolini and Mao and so on and so forth, that the concept of charisma became seen mainly as a political, before that it had been mainly a religious, you know, sort of term, about these figures who come along, these messianic figures who come along and, you know, have this capacity to have people identify with them on unprecedented sort of levels, and to submit to them as these kind of authority figures, but a different kind of authority figure. And it was not applied much to entertainment, certainly, to figures in popular culture, except in a very kind of lax and unrigorous way. It was just a kind of interesting term to use, you know, in this way. But the essence of what Weber was getting at is that there are two kinds of authority in the world. One is a kind of patriarchal authority, which is the sort of the authority of the hierarchical authority that dominates most societies. And then there's charismatic authority, and charismatic authority is the antagonist to hierarchical or patriarchal authority. It arises or it gains traction in times of social distress and social dislocation, and it has to do with the way that people convert their sense of fear and distress and so on into this type of outlandish enthusiasm for particular figures. Weber said that it is charisma is a form of devotion that's born of distress and enthusiasm, which sounds like they're contradictory terms, and the contradiction there is what makes it especially potent. And in terms, when I was familiar with this, and I familiarized myself with it, and so on and so forth. But the two parts of this that, without getting into a kind of professorial mode of talking about something like the Beatles, which of course they would have ridiculed, you know, soundly, someone like me going on like this about this. The two things that I found interesting about it were, first of all, the awareness that the trigger for the Beatle phenomenon in Britain did seem to have to do with the Profumo scandal that I was talking about earlier, which in turn was interpreted by many people as evidence that some fundamental sort of nature of British society was falling apart. And then, of course, in Britain, in America, I think it's almost a truism to say that something about the intervention of the Kennedy assassination, the assassination of John F. Kennedy in November 1963, a month before the Beatles suddenly appear on the radar screen of American teenagers, that too somehow charged their phenomenon. And in the book, I talk a lot about the particular impact of the Kennedy assassination on adolescents in America, having to do with their sense of who Kennedy was and the sort of president he was and so on and so forth. And without getting into all of that, well, that's the that's the obvious distress component that's involved here. And there, too, there was a sense in America in the months after the Kennedy assassination, the same kind of what the hell is going on in this country feeling that existed in Britain around the political sex scandal that had taken place there. And I think there's something to be gained from understanding the way that a large numbers of anxious, and of course adolescents are anxious anyway, but large numbers of especially anxious adolescents in Britain and America attached themselves to the Beatles, identified with the Beatles, idealized the Beatles as these larger than life figures, as a way on some kind of social psychological level of coping with this generalized feeling of distress and dislocation that seemed to have so much influence in their world at that time. And then, so that's the, you know, that's the way in which a kind of formal sociological concept like charisma, actually has some relevance to something like this, I think.
And let's hear the Beatles on the radio on the BBC doing their version of Money. And then we'll come back and I want to ask you about the feminist angle on the fan hysteria. So this is the Beatles doing Money. And that was the Beatles on live radio, which was a huge element in their arsenal of media weapons. But one thing I want to get to before we wrap up is you talked about the hysteria angle on the female reaction to the Beatles. But in the book, you bring out a more feminist analysis of this and explain how it was empowering for girls to go crazy at the Beatles shows.
Sure. Well, I mean, to me, you know, when I first started to move from writing just about the music to writing about the general phenomenon, one of the promises I made to myself was I wanted to do justice to what the girls were feeling. Okay. Because first of all, the whole thing never would have happened if it hadn't been for them. Their hysteria was the thing that brought the Beatles to the attention of the British press. Their hysteria was the thing that arrested, the American audience from the very beginning. I mean, in their Ed Sullivan show, appearance in February 1964, for the first time ever, the cameras on the Ed Sullivan show showed the audience reacting, showed these girls in these paroxysms of whatever they were in, right? So it was a huge part, and I wanted to do justice to it. I didn't want to just sort of like treat it as if it was some kind of amusing sort of acting out on their part. And several people, Barbara Ehrenreich, who's a wonderful among other things, feminist author, wrote quite eloquently about this, in the sense that what the girls, first of all, the press treated it, it seemed as if this was an audience of teenage girls who, God forbid, appeared to be having orgasms in their seats, right? And you couldn't exactly say that, right? Especially not in the early 1960s media environment. But you could allude to it, and you could wink at it, and at the same time, you could feel an enormous sense of distaste and inhibition about the idea that this might be going on. Okay. I don't think that's what it was. I've spoken with many young women who were in those audiences, and they weren't having orgasms. But they were definitely enthralled to something that was taking them completely out of themselves. And what I think is most interesting about it, of course, the sexual aspect of it, the idea that they were asserting themselves, that 14-year-old girls, and this meant even more in Britain than it did in the United States, because British society was considerably more repressed than American society in many ways. But the idea that 14-year-old girls were giving vent to these kind of simulations of orgasm in response to these male, let's use the term, idols, you know, standing in front of them, that in itself was an enormous statement on their part. The screaming got started, spontaneously, because young teenage girls have a tendency to scream or squeal in certain situations. And it gradually became institutionalized. It gradually became actually the signature of Beatle fans. And of course, you know, by the end of 1963, they never stopped in the concerts. I mean, the Beatles were playing to this din of girls just screaming constantly the whole time. But what's most interesting about it is not the extent to which they were out of control, as far as I'm concerned. What's most interesting about it is the extent to which they were in control. And the extent to which they were basically engaging in this behavior, which by most standards, after all, screaming in public is generally considered to be a form of misbehavior, right? But the Beatles not only sanctioned it, well, first of all, the Beatles did sanction it, right? And that was an enormous permission that they gave to their audience. There's a many quotes from them, but George Harrison talking one time about how the fans, quote unquote, have a right to scream the place down if that's what they do. The idea being that, you know what, you're paying to be here. You can do what you want. Well, you can do what you want is not a message that was delivered to a great many teenagers in America or Britain in 1963 and 1964. On the contrary, you can't do that. It was the main, you know, was the main issue that the main command that the teenagers were receiving in their lives, as has always been the case. So the sense of permission that the Beatles gave, especially to the girls, to behave this way, and the realization on the part of the girls that nobody could stop it. Nobody could do anything about it, right? And so it became, in to my way of thinking, this incredible expression, again, a collective expression, a group expression of their social power. These young women were taking over. They were taking over theaters. They were taking over the streets outside of theaters. Those are all expressions of social power. And again, nobody could stop them. Nobody could do anything about it. So there was something enormously empowering about it, and it didn't just have to do with sex. Some of it had to do simply with power. And writers like I mentioned before, Barbara Ehrenreich, see this as a kind of dress rehearsal, as a kind of prelude to the women's movement, which, of course, as the 1960s goes on, and as, by the way, those young women grow up, right, you know, suddenly becomes an enormously significant, possibly the most significant social movement to come out of the 1960s in the long run. So I've always been intrigued by that connection there and by that linkage there in that way.
And thanks for bringing that to attention. And obviously, we didn't cover the whole Beatles phenomenon or even close, but we took a stab at it, and I hope to have you back on to discuss your book. This is Jonathan Gould. The book is Can't Buy Me Love, The Beatles, Britain, and America. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, there's a lot more to talk about in their careers, and I'd love to do some more.
We'll do it.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on iTunes, Spotify, and Facebook, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at @LetItRollCast. Nate returns next week with Zach O'Malley Greenberg, author of Three Kings, Diddy, Dr. Dre, Jay-Z, and hip-hop's multi-billion-dollar rise. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to all the other great Pantheon podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Can't Buy Me Love, The Beatles, Britain, and America is published by Three Rivers Press. Please support our show by ordering via the Amazon referral link on our website, letitrollpodcast.com.
Hey, diggers, this is an announcement. Episode 18 is on the way. We are in the final polish. All the bodywork, sanding, and the paint has been put on this rocket ship, so we just need that final coat to finish. Coming out of the last few episodes of the Rock and Roll Archaeology podcast that concentrated on specific geographies like London, LA, San Francisco, and New York, we are now in the home stretch of our time in the 1960s. And so with this one, it's not about a place on a map, but a year in the life. It's called Episode 18, 1969, and it's a year so big in rock and roll, it'll take two episodes to tell the full tale. Part 1 will cover mostly the first half of the year. We'll spend most of our time in the UK checking in with the Beatles as they are beginning to fray internally, while friends and competitors, the Rolling Stones, are about to become the greatest rock and roll band in the world. Of course, the Fab Four are still able to be the Beatles, so therefore they are not going down without a fight. And the Glimmer Twins must make a sacrifice to achieve the greatness of that 68-73 run of peak Stones. Then we go beyond England and America and venture into outer space, where we dissect the moonshot and how it affected society and the arts. So, like the sci-fi that surrounds the very real human endeavor, we will peek into the future ourselves with some rock and rollers that will really take us into the next decade. So hold tight, it won't be long now. It's coming, and we think you will all be pleased. Episode 18, 1969, Part 1, Tell a Friend.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.